What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Devir Bargal, expert on the Jews of Shanghai and the Shanghai Ghetto. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shin Shiniot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I recently returned from Shanghai, China, where I led High Holy Day services, Shabbat events, classes, and other programs for Kehilat Shanghai, the only progressive synagogue in Shanghai. It was a remarkable and highly enjoyable experience for many reasons, not least of which that I was leading a small Jewish congregation in the largest and most dynamic city in the whole world. There are 24 million people living in Shanghai proper, another 10 million in the larger metropolitan area. It is an awesome city that works and is an incredibly vital place economically and culturally. One of the most intriguing things about China was that every Jew I met said approximately the same thing. There is no anti-Semitism in China. In fact, people tend to say there's a kind of bias in favor of Jews, a pro- or philo-Semitism that leads Chinese people to think that Jews are smart, capable, and good at business. These are very high values in today's China. There are more than 50 books in Chinese that advertise that they teach the Jewish way to do business, and there's a city in China credited with inventing Chinese banking that's colloquially referred to as a Jewish city, although it has no Jews. Banking is considered a great fiscal accomplishment, and Jews are understood to have invented it originally. The Chinese also believe Jews are excellent in raising smart, capable, successful children. A friend suggested a definite future bestseller in China would be The Jewish Mother's Guide to Raising Successful Children. It wouldn't have to be published in English at all, just Chinese. There's definitely a huge market for it. On rare occasions, it seems, old stereotypes can actually be of benefit. Which helps explain why during World War II there was no objection from the Chinese government to accepting Jewish refugees in fairly large numbers, creating the so-called Shanghai Ghetto. China wasn't wealthy then. It surely is on the way to being so now. There are more exotic automobiles on the streets of Shanghai than in New York, Beverly Hills, and London combined. But back during World War II, living standards weren't what Jews from Vienna, Berlin, or Warsaw were used to experiencing. But there was no persecution by the Chinese, and even when the Japanese conquered Shanghai, conditions were equally difficult for everyone. In fact, Jews sometimes had it better than the Chinese did under Japanese military occupation. And although we Jews have always been a small minority everywhere, with the exception of Israel and certain boroughs of New York City, the experience of minorityhood in China is more intensive by several orders of magnitude. There are between 3,000 and 5,000 Jews in Shanghai, out of a population of 24 million. That translates to 0.02%. About 2 out of every 10,000 people are Jewish. That's a really tiny minority in a huge world-class city. Which means that if you want to retain your Jewish identity and teach it to your children, you have to choose to do so willingly and consistently. You're not going to be actively Jewish by accident, as you can be in some places in the world, nor by simply doing what your neighbors are doing. You don't have to find refuge from anti-Semites with other Jews, because that's not the reality in China. You can find bagels, there are several places in central Shanghai, but you can't assume anything else about affirming Judaism. You have to choose to involve yourself, to act, to own your Jewish life. All of which makes experiencing Judaism in Shanghai and observing the High Holy Days and Shabbat there quite different from celebrating it anywhere else. Everyone is active in the congregation I served because she or he has chosen to be so. Everyone is there very much by choice. which powerfully reinforced for me an important theme of Judaism. I set before you today a choice. For the 10 days of repentance that I was there, that choice is to follow mitzvot, to choose good and not evil. In Shanghai, at Kehilat Shanghai, it is also a choice to be Jewish and to create Jewish community, to share in the fantastic tradition, culture, and religion that enrich lives, all of our lives, in so many non-monetary ways. If you want to add meaning and purpose to your life, Judaism is here for you. And in Shanghai, if you want that, you have to choose it. That's a great lesson for every Jewish community in the whole world, isn't it? Because it's equally true for us in our own communities as it is in faraway China. If we want to be Jewish in meaningful ways, it's up to us to do so. It's humbling, but also inspirational. A wonderful impetus for each of us to commit to building our own synagogues with that same level of commitment. To play us in this morning, here's a song about humility. A beautiful one, Katonti, from Yonatan Razel.
Katonti mikol hachasadim u'mikol ha'emet asher asita et avdecha. Katonti mikol hachasadim u'mikol ha'emet asher asita et avdecha. Katonti mikol hachasadim.
That was Yonatan Razel singing his song Katonti. Dvir Bargal may well be the greatest expert in the world on the fascinating history of the Jews of the world's largest city, Shanghai. Begun by Sephardic Jewish traders in the 19th century, the Jewish community of Shanghai, China, became a haven for a large population of Jews fleeing the Holocaust during World War II. Learn this remarkable story from our guest, Dvir Bargal, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Dvir Bargal. is an expert, perhaps the preeminent expert, on the Jews of Shanghai, China, a remarkable and fascinating community. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Cohen. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
It was lovely to have you with us here in the High Holidays.
Thank you.
All the community was very impressed with that.
Well, I loved it. It was a fascinating and a very rich experience. Tell us how you became interested in the history of the Jews of Shanghai.
To be frank, it was completely coincidence. I used to work in the Israeli television before I moved to Shanghai. And then about 17 years ago, I decided to make a bit of a change. I moved to here, realizing the future is in China, and expecting that if there's a billion point five people, that probably there are billion stories that in Israel at least nobody knew about. And I came to Shanghai, and sometime shortly after I came, I took myself the Jewish heritage tour that was given by another Israeli lady. Her name is Georgia. I find the whole story fascinating about the Jews of Shanghai, because in Israel we actually don't get to learn anything about it, about the Jews from the Far East, the Jews from China, a big hole in education, if you ask me, in the Israeli education system. So the story was fascinating to me. But then because I was working in the media, Georgia, after the tour, she thought I might be interested in a story that antique shops in Shanghai selling old Jewish gravestones from the former Jewish cemeteries that used to be in the city. Mm. When she told me about it the first time, I wasn't thinking I would be busy with that. 5 years before I came to Shanghai, I shot in Bulgaria, in Sofia, in the area there of Sofia. Jewish cemeteries in a poor condition, and it was a hard sell in Israel. We couldn't make. Nobody make any more headlines from these kind of things in Israel. But then she explained to me, Georgia, that in Shanghai in the past used to have 4 Jewish cemeteries. It took me a while, but I will learn later that there were 3,700 Jewish graves in the city of Shanghai. And today, basically, in a city of 25 million people today, in one of the leading urbans in the world, you can't find even one single Jewish gravestone. So they all disappeared during the many years of communism, almost 60 years that China was clothing itself to the West. And for the last 30 years, from the late 1980s, when it reopened itself to the West, all the time people are coming, some people even arriving to look for places of burials. Nobody could point them where to look for that, or even to tell them why it's not in the city anymore. So we decided to start a research. We went to the antique shop that sold the gravestones, and from there the research led us outside Shanghai, basically in villages area, where I started to look at Jewish gravestones, people using them like washboard, stepping stones, part of construction. I was not expecting to do it when I came to Shanghai, but through this research, I learned much more about the Jewish history here. Something about 16 years ago, sometime after I came, the Georgia who gave the tours went back to live in Israel. She asked me if I would like to help her with these heritage tours, and practically I'm doing it ever since.
I think you are clearly the preeminent expert on that. I should note that there's a fascinating World War II history in particular, and we'll come back and talk about that with Devir Bargal, exploring the Jews of Shanghai, China, in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, that means House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue based in northwest Tucson, is proud and excited to announce its first services, classes, and events beginning October 19th, 2018, this coming Friday night. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that will strive each day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the northwest region of Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area. It provides weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend the inaugural services this Friday night, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or go to beitsimchatucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona for its very beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, our maven on Israel. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So now that all the holidays are behind us, it's time to think about going to Israel. You're leading a trip to, co-leading a trip to Israel with many, many other people. Tell us about the trip, but tell us also why, in your view, it's important to go to Israel.
I think it's very simple. You know, first of all, the Weintraub Israel Center really emphasizes on building relationship with Israel and with Israelis. And you can't really build relationship without a person-to-person contact. Learning about Israel in a classroom is one thing. Visiting Israel and seeing in your own eyes and experience it from your own eyes and build your own story of Israel is important in my eyes. And I can share with you just one small thing that I've been a classroom teacher for many, many years, middle school and high school. And I've taught about Israel. That was one of the topics. And when I had like a modern Israel class. And so I can sit there and talk about an operation, a military operation that started, you know, just to bring back home three teenagers who were kidnapped. But we happened to be in Israel with 11 graders, and we happened to be in one of the special forces that went out to search for them. And we went to an empty base. And when the children asked me, the teens asked me, Mr. Eden, what's going on? Why is this base empty? And I said the truth. They're all out there searching for our brothers. So this is something that, you know, you can't teach in a classroom. And I strongly encourage every listener of our program to go to Israel. Go alone, go with your family, go with Weintraub Israel Center, but just go to Israel. It's very important.
Go with your synagogue. You know,
go with your synagogue, of course, with any organizations.
No, I think it's
great.
The
more, the better.
You know, in leading a trip, there's so many different ways you can go. Okay, everybody's going to go to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, right?
That's a given, yeah. Masada.
It's a law. You go to Masada. You've got people who are there for the first time, of course. See the Dead Sea.
Yes.
Go to the Galilee. See the Kinneret.
Right.
All of those, but that's not really the most important part of Israel, although hard to argue with Jerusalem.
Right.
What do you think the most important connection people make is?
Well, to be honest, you know, there are two things. One is, of course, you know, cover the tourist attraction, cover the things that are most important to
holiest places.
Right,
for
of
Jews,
course, of course, of course. But I actually have a different angle outside of the box, which is, I think, you know, to look at your passion. Look at your passion. What is it you like? Because Israel, yes, it's the Jewish state and it's a very special place, but it's a country with people who wake up in the morning and go to work and provide to their families and play sports and, you know, and read together and hike together or alone, and they do things that we do. And so I think that if you look at your passions and you try to match them and you go and you visit real people, you know, and you coordinate ahead of time and have the same interest and have the same passions, and then you not only visited Israel, but you bring Israel back with
home
you.
With you.
Yes.
It's a great way to be. Thanks so much, Amir. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking the last couple of weeks about this resurgence of nationalism, tribalism, and last week you talked about the tremendous change in the last century. I think you could even narrow it down. There's tremendous technological change right now that's affecting people all over. And the reaction to it is sometimes to drop back into old, established, traditional values. A shot of the past will save us from all of this change. I want to get a little more specific about some of the places where we've seen this kind of resurgence. We talked kind of briefly about Eastern Europe last week, but you know, we don't talk very much about what's happened to the Jews in, well, I guess across the former Soviet Union, but it's a very strange place to be right now if you're Jewish, I think, in part because of these kind of weird nationalist reactions. Or behind the Iron Curtain might be a better description.
Right. Well, what was traditionally long before the Soviet times, it was czarist soil.
Yeah.
Okay, but that...
Which might have been the most anti-Semitic country in the world in that period.
But that soil, whether it's in Ukraine or Belarus or the Russian Federation, whatever, the soil and the air seem impregnated with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism seems to flow in mother's milk in those countries. Yeah. And it's, you know, it, I think, waxes and wanes with the times, but certainly... Look, it's fair to say that countries that are more economically vulnerable, countries which are undergoing more traumatic social and economic change, such as all the post-communist countries, whether you're talking Cuba, Russia, China is not a post-communist country. It's still a communist country, but
communist,
it's
capitalist, socialist
competing
world.
More in the capitalist world. I mean, these countries are undergoing humongous social strain, and they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to cushion it the way a Western country that's more prosperous like Sweden or Switzerland or even the United States might choose to cushion it. And then that's a question of government policy. But some countries just don't have the means. And, you know, the difference between a 25-year-old person living in China and a 75-year-old person living in China is like the difference between an Earthling and a Martian.
Right.
One grew up in the age of computers and cell phones and whatever and doesn't feel threatened by that.
And diverse clothing and styles and fashions.
Right. He or she may feel out of the mainstream and cut off from opportunity, but not the sense of threat or even panic that many older people feel. And what I think you're seeing is two things. There's a growing divergence between young and old generations, which doesn't prevent all the young people from becoming far right. But there's also a growing divergence between rich and poor that's almost worldwide. And only the countries that control that very carefully, countries that we would label in a denigrating way as socialist countries, you know, horrible places like the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, whatever. only those countries.
Those countries where people are happiest, by the way.
Right. Oh, and where there's universal health care and universal access to higher education and people do much better on standardized tests of science and math than our citizens. But those countries manage to limit the disparity between rich and poor and between the younger and older generation, and manage to provide their citizens with a greater sense of continuity and comfort.
You know, the one thing I can say is these are interesting times. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi is in the hospital room of a critically ill congregant. The man Moshe has been an important member of the shul for decades. The rabbi is close to him. Suddenly Moshe, intubated and unable to speak, motions for the rabbi to come close. Thinking he will hear the man's last request, the rabbi does so. But with the tube in his mouth, Moshe can't speak. The rabbi grabs a pad of paper and a pencil, hands it to Moshe. The dying man scribbles furiously, but just as he finishes the note, gives it to the rabbi, the alarms go off. The monitors show no heart rate. Moshe collapses and dies. In all the hubbub, the rabbi puts the note in his suit pocket and forgets it. At the funeral, the rabbi is eulogizing Moshe beautifully when he brushes the podium and realizes he has the note in his pocket. Thinking quickly, he decides to read Moshe's note aloud at that moment. It so happens I have here the last words of this righteous man on this very paper. I'll read them now. And the rabbi reads in a stentorian voice, "Rabbi, you're standing on my air hose." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our representatives of the Weintraub Israel Center on Israel, our young representatives, I should say, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benekot. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So you guys have been here long enough now to, and I use the term you guys because, of course, in Israel you never use a phrase like that, to have some comparisons between Israel and America. What's really obviously different in lifestyle here?
So one thing that we paid attention to...
Now, you didn't say it quietly before we got on mic here. what time do we eat dinner in America? What time do you eat dinner in Israel?
We usually eat, like, the earliest time that we would eat dinner in Israel would be 7:30.
7:30 p.m., right.
And here, it's like 5, and by 10 or 9, you're hungry again. So that's really different for us.
Yeah, totally crazy.
Yeah, I got to a dinner at 4:30, and I was like, what?
4:30 on a...
This is my lunch.
Dinner or something, right.
Yeah, this is my lunch. I don't know what you're talking
now,
about.
Of course, like, if you have small kids, this was an education for me, too. When I first had kids, suddenly, you know, kids were eating at 5 o'clock, and right. I was looking around because by 10 o'clock yeah. I was hungry for dinner again.
Yeah, exactly.
So in Israel, usually 7:30, and by the way, in Europe it could be even later. We know, like in Spain, 10, 11 o'clock wow. at night, people start to get dinner.
Well, that's really late.
But definitely dinner. What else is different for you besides our crazy early dinner habits here?
I think because we live in a moshav, which is a settlement, like a really small town in Israel. We didn't have that much accessibility around, and we needed to go far to buy anything from food to whatever we needed,
clothing and stuff, supplies, right.
And here everything is accessible. Everything is like 5 minutes away. You can get anything you want at a certain time, like the exact same time and place. So it's really different for me, and I'm still getting used to it.
You know, it's funny. Moshav is such a small, tight community. So if you had to go 15 minutes, where would you go?
We actually live in the same area, which is next to Ashkelon.
Right.
It's kind of in the south of Israel.
Ashkelon area there.
Yeah,
right,
exactly. Right. So we would go to Ashkelon, Ashdod, Sderot, which is other big cities in the area.
By the way, Sderot is a town. It's not a big city.
It's okay.
It's for me.
It's famous for getting a lot of missiles, the rockets that hit it, but otherwise not a big city.
No, it's big for us because we're from a moshav.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, but still, it's not. Even those cities, you can get what you can get here. Obviously, Tucson is huge, and I can't even imagine having.
So I recently
big.
Came back from Shanghai, the largest city in the world. Tucson no longer wow. seems so big to me. So, you know, you really don't go very far. You know, you go, you would get your stuff done. It's close by. You don't think about, oh, okay, I'll go drive half an hour to go have dinner.
No, we don't. It's all
it's
really
all local,
different.
Homegrown, close to home.
Exactly. The past 2 months are just helping us to get used to everything.
You will be so different when you go back.
Yeah, it will be so difficult to get used again to the Israeli culture after being here for a year.
You'll adapt. You're young. We will talk next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Lech Lecha that includes God's great commandment to Abraham. Lech Lecha me'artzecha me'molaretcha me'beit avicha. Leave. Go from your country and your homeland to the house of your father, a land that I will show you. It's the beginning of monotheism, the belief in one God. It's the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well, a dramatic and powerful moment. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he's known. After all, if he's to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism and a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of supreme justice or divine power, a corrupt, dishonest, ethically failed civilization. If you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, sometimes you need to leave home in order to do it. So Abraham picked up. He left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon. He journeyed outward to find God and found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't do what God commands, there is no Judaism or Christianity or Islam or monotheism, or really Western civilization at all. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha is that after God commanded him to go, he simply went without argument or controversy. That strikes any reader as a very un-Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture is argument and discussion. If you're directed to leave everything you have ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, well, wouldn't you at least complain a little? And don't think Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. In fact, in next week's Torah portion, he will prove that he can argue and bargain with God to the last degree. He does so when trying to defend the very few righteous people of Sodom and Gomorrah from destruction. No, something else is at work here, the essential understanding that we all have that sometimes we just have to move on, leave what we know, embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, challenging yet essential. And when we choose to take the first steps, we, like Abraham, may reap rich rewards. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Dvir Bargal, will explain why Shanghai became such a haven for Jews and what became of the community after Mao's revolution took control of China. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Two Israelis were killed, another injured in a terror attack in the Barkhan industrial section of the West Bank. The attack took place at the beginning of a work week at the settlement's industrial zone, home to 160 factories that employ thousands of Palestinian and Jewish workers together. The man and woman died of injuries at the scene. The third person, a woman in her 50s, was taken to nearby Israeli hospital in serious but stable condition. The dead were identified as Kim Levengrod Yechezkel, 29 years old, of Rosh Ha'ayin, central Israel, and Ziv Hajbi, a 35-year-old father of three from Rishon LeZion in central Israel. They both were tied up and murdered by being shot at close range. This terror attack is the first of its kind in the Barkhan Industrial Park. The attacker, who used an assault rifle and reportedly knew the two dead victims, was caught on security cameras leaving the factory where he had shot his victims. He was employed there for several months and had a pass. He left behind a suicide note with a friend. The IDF launched a search for the attacker, identified as a 23-year-old Palestinian from the village of Shweika near the West Bank city of Tulkarm. "This is a serious terror attack," said IDF spokesman Ronan Manlis. "He may have had other motives, but we unequivocally state that this is a terrorist attack in light of other findings we have." Manlis called the Barkhan Industrial Zone an area of coexistence in which Palestinians work daily with a permit alongside Jews. "We are examining the events of the day, but it's clear to all of us that preserving this coexistence is part of the Army's mission. We will continue to do so." Israel's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu at the weekly cabinet meeting called the shootings a severe terrorist attack. "The security forces are in pursuit of the reprehensible murderer. I am certain they will apprehend him. I am also certain we will deal with him to the fullest extent of the law and quickly." "This was not only an attack on innocent people," said President Reuven Rivlin, "going about their daily lives. It was also an attack on the possibility of Israelis and Palestinians coexisting peacefully. I call on the Palestinian leadership to condemn this murderous attack, to use the forces at their disposal to capture the terrorist and those who aided him." "Unfortunately, but typically, the Hamas terror organization called the attack a new chapter in our resistance in the West Bank. The incident has proven that attempts of the Palestinian Authority to normalize relations with the Zionist occupier were unsuccessful." In news from Europe, Swedish prosecutors appealed to their country's Supreme Court against a lower tribunal's decision not to deport a Palestinian immigrant who firebombed the synagogue in Sweden. The unusual appeal last week by the public prosecutor's office is of a June court decision not to deport Gazan-born Feres al-Nadim, who attacked a synagogue in Gothenburg in December with two accomplices. The appeal follows vocal protests about his trial by Israel and the World Jewish Congress. Last month, a Swedish appeals court overturned a criminal tribunal's ruling from June stating that al-Nadim would be deported to Israel at the end of his two-year prison term. The firebombing, he and his accomplices said, was a kind of reprisal for President Donald Trump's decision to have the U.S. recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Since al-Nadim committed a crime that could be perceived as a threat to other Jews, and that Israel might be interested in the matter, the appeals court ruled that one cannot safeguard the man's fundamental human rights if he is deported. The public prosecutor's office decided to appeal the ruling in the Supreme Court because there is no reason to assume that a man would be subject to death penalty, torture, or other inhuman treatment upon return. Arnon Verstandig, president of the Council of Swedish Jewish Communities, called the prosecutor's appeal an important decision. He said the community expects the Supreme Court to order al-Nadim's deportation. In Fairfax, Virginia, 19 swastikas were spray-painted on the walls of a Jewish community center. The vandalism was discovered last weekend at the JCC of Northern Virginia in Fairfax, Virginia. Surveillance video showed a man wearing dark clothes spraying the swastikas at about 4:30 a.m. These acts do not represent the community around the J or the community in Northern Virginia, Fairfax JCC Executive Director Jeff Danick said. The J as a whole, and particularly through the focused efforts of our Committee for a Just and Caring Community, will continue to participate as a positive force in both the Jewish and wider communities. This is the second suspected hate crime against the Fairfax JCC in the last 18 months. In April 2017, Hitler was right. Swastikas and the SS symbol were found spray-painted on the exterior of the JCC. A nearby church was also vandalized. Dylan Mahone, 20 years old, was arrested and charged with hate-related offenses in the incident. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, said in a tweet showing a photo of the vandalized JCC, "An insidious rise in hateful actions and anti-Semitism is happening in Virginia and across the country. We must meet it with fierce condemnation and overabundance of love and unity. We cannot allow hate to fester." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. He's the extraordinary guide, expert, author, Dvir Bargal, an Israeli media personality and journalist who moved to Shanghai, China, and has become the preeminent expert on the Jews of Shanghai, China. Tell us when Jews first came to Shanghai. You know, some listeners to Two Jewish may have heard of the Jews of Kaifeng, which goes back to the Silk Road, but that's not really the origin of the modern Jewish community of Shanghai, is it?
Correct. In the Jewish community of Shanghai just started to build up somewhere in the middle 19th century following the Opium War. It's a long story, but the Opium War was a war when the British tried to force opium trade on China in order to balance the trade with China. All these commercial wars that Trump is trying to make now with China even started almost 200 years ago when the British realizing at that time they're losing balance of trade with China. So the first opium war in China, China lost, and as a result, the Chinese and the British signed a peace contract called the Treaty of Nanjing that was signed in 1842. And as a result of that, the British took city parts of China to run them and to control them. Following that, the first Jewish man from the Sassoon family coming basically from a Baghdadi region, coming to look for business opportunities for the Sassoon corporation, the Sassoon family from Shanghai, following the Opium War. So he arrived in 1845 and basically is the first Jewish man recorded to come to modern China looking for business opportunities, opening the office, start to bring people to work for them, and the Sassoon made fortune by opium trading that was legal to do by the British who controlled. And then they brought many other people of Baghdadi Jewish origin, and they became extremely prominent. And they were the movers and the shakers of the city of Shanghai in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
And you know, Shanghai, of course, a trading city, has become perhaps the preeminent trading city for all of China throughout the Far East now. The Baghdadi Jewish community, Jewish trading families, including the Kaduris, as you mentioned, the famous Sassoon family, you can find those names all over the Near East, Hong Kong, Singapore. But in Shanghai, they really built some of the institutions and some of the original synagogues, too, didn't they, in Shanghai?
Correct. So with about 110 years of history, from the middle 19th century, from that opium war, up to the Communist Revolution, they become more in 1949. So within almost 110 years, these Baghdadi Jews, first of all, starting to build business trading and in trading, and then build a community. And as a result of the community, you need to build establishment. Of course, some of the establishment of Jewish communities will be synagogues. There were six historical synagogues in the city of Shanghai. Unfortunately, from different reasons, mainly because of commercialism, we lost four of them. Two of them standing today, including one of them that was built by that Sassoon family, by Sir Jacob Sassoon. It's called Ohel Rachel. He named it after his wife, built it in 1920. And that was the synagogue of the Baghdadi community in the city. To our luck, he's still standing. To our misfortune, it is controlled now by the Ministry of Education of Shanghai, and they allow very, very limited access to the building.
The after the sort of early period of Shanghai Jewish history, some institutions were built. As you mentioned, there were at the time graveyards and some synagogues. The principal time of arrival for so many Jews was in the 1930s. I understand there were perhaps even some Jewish gangsters in the 1920s. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, Shanghai had a community of 30,000 people, Jewish people. And Shanghai, historically, is a city of open port, which means whoever need to come and even need to run away is welcome in the city. So you can imagine what type of people will come, from refugees to crooks and criminals. And apparently there were also of that type of Jewish people that arrived Shanghai and became very successful, head of clubs and bars, the kings of slot machines, the rickshaw king of Shanghai. The Jews were the prominent people who basically ran the city in many different ways. The underworld was one way that Jews were also thriving here in Shanghai.
In the 1930s, when Jews were trying to get out of Europe and were blocked because they couldn't get visas to go anywhere, tell us a little bit about how so many Jews began to come to Shanghai.
So we started, I mentioned earlier the Baghdadi Jews who came, the traders, and they were a small group of people, about 1,000, extremely wealthy to the most of them, but still very small community. The second wave of immigration coming in the early 20th century, mostly of a Russian origin, running away from pogroms, from anti-Semitism in Russia. In those days, Russian Jews went all over the world, as you may know, and mostly to America, Ellis Island and other places. And pretty much like they did in the other countries, also they are contributing to Shanghai by developing a layer of mid-class business and academical profession. So we're talking about delis, bakeries, pharmacies, groceries, but as well there were musicians, teachers, lawyers from this Russian community. We're talking more or less 1900 till 1930. But then in the late 1930s, when these Russians already started to settle down and to have their life in Shanghai, will arrive the third community of Jewish people, refugees who ran away from the Holocaust, primarily from Germany, Austria, and Poland. Now, in the late 1930s, basically almost every other country rejected the Jewish people who looked away out of Europe. One by one, the countries say no to them, put quotas on them, or simply didn't let visas. Well, Shanghai was standing as an open port. Open port meant that everyone could come without any visa, without any passport, not really with any need to answer proper questions when they landed or arrived in Shanghai, either by ship or by train. So it was kind of one last resort that people could start to think about in Europe that they can head to.
There were certain kind of heroes who, consuls and other consular officials, who gave the visas to get out of Europe. So in order for Jews to even get to Shanghai, they had to get out often. One of them was a Chinese. I mean, some of us have heard of Sugihara, the famous Japanese consul who did that. But there was a Chinese guy who did it too that I think most Jews don't know anything about. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
That's correct. I find this story fascinating as well. One of the many unknown stories that I'm trying to tell for my heritage tour. You spoke about the Sugihara, the Japanese consul who served in Kovno, Lithuania, and signed thousands of transit papers to Polish Jews. But what people less known is that a bit even earlier, in 1938-39, a Chinese consul in Vienna, Austria, in the name of Dr. Ho, was also signing papers that led Viennese Jews to leave Vienna and to head to other places. Many of them went to Shanghai. The full name is Feng Shang-ho. He was the first consul of China in Vienna, and especially after the Anschluss, where the Germans took over Austria, there was no more embassy of the Chinese in Austria. So he was the first consul in the consulate. And in a period of relatively short time of 2 years, he was signing on his own decision many papers that allowed those Viennese to leave Austria and to end up between Shanghai and other places.
You know, I can't help but think of these Viennese Jews coming in, I'm sure their wonderful warm wool clothing to Shanghai, with their violins. You know, I realize it's probably a stereotype, but it must have been quite a cultural shock to arrive in China in those days.
Your stereotype is not too wrong. I mean, among the refugees that came to Shanghai, there were 450 musicians, from actually playing music to singers to chazanim to people who deal with music. That was their occupation. So yeah, imagine yourself those who play in the best concerts of Europe, the best concerts all in Vienna and so on. Now they need, first of all, to run away with their life, to pack the whatever they can, and from the violin to clothing and toothbrush, going first of all to Italy and then taking a ship that took them almost a month long through the Mediterranean Sea, passing the Suez Canal, stopping in many ports on the way to the Far East, but those ports didn't welcome them, so they had to keep sailing until they arriving the port of Shanghai. And we're talking about Shanghai 1930s. People were pulling rickshaws, mafias, bordellos, criminals, and not paving streets. Imagine yourself all the cultural shock of these Viennese, Oyo German Berliners, and so on, landing in Shanghai, almost with no money, because the Nazis permitted them, to most of them, to carry with them up to 10 Reichsmarks, which was worth about $4.90 in those days. Mm. So coming to start a new life with less than a $5, with cultural shock, with their suits and ties and hats, looking for to integrate in a new place in order to basically save their life. They are refugees now.
So as soon as they got there, they did what Jews always do. I mean, once they got situated, and they were helped, I think, in getting situated by some of the Baghdadi Jews, they started to establish Jewish institutions, so restaurants, and participated in synagogues, newspapers, concerts, all of those kinds of things. It must have been, you know, we tend to typically think every country in the world is anti-Semitic. That was not their experience in arriving in Shanghai. That didn't seem to be the case in China.
That's correct. The Chinese, people know a little about the Far East, but the Far East, as I have to say, Rabbi, thank God they are not monotheistic. People believe in the Far East in different beliefs. And the Chinese, or even the Japanese, never grew up hatred to Jews that come from religious motivations as it was in Europe. So, yeah, they landed in Shanghai in this kind of exotic and the wild east for them. But the locals never discriminate them being Jewish people. The Chinese, if you want, always have something for the underdog, and Jews symbolize the underdogs. We have refugees landing here. The Chinese themselves were basically victims in their own land by the Japanese. And the Jews filled the poorest neighborhood of the city, living almost next door with Chinese, while the Chinese don't see them as a competition, as an enemy, as the people who come to take their jobs or their life. While the conditions was horrible for those refugees who arrived in Shanghai, very poor. People say, one of my guests said, we suffer hunger. We never starved, but we were very, very hungry. So they lived relatively with peaceful manner with the local Chinese.
All of that lasted until the Japanese captured Shanghai. There was a huge war. Japan had invaded China. You could say that World War II started with the Japanese invasion of China earlier in the 1930s. When the Japanese came in, there was a great deal of fear, I'm sure, because the Japanese were allies of the Nazis. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, the Japanese invaded China in 1937 with a mighty power, took most of the country. But Shanghai, that was basically controlled by many foreign powers, British, American, French, and others, from 37 until 41, the Japanese never really touched the international part of Shanghai in order not to create an international war. It was only in the day of Pearl Harbor, basically in the Far East, it was the date already, December 8th of 41, the Japanese taking over the international part of Shanghai. And from that day on, Shanghai was a completely Japanese city until the end of the Second World War, until after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, their allies were the Nazis, and the Nazis, probably, as we know, had other issues and other plans with Jews. So, apparently, kind of influenced by the decisions or requests of the Nazis, the Japanese, in February of 43, publishing what they called the Proclamation. And in that proclamation, basically, they wrote, I will call this a command, that all the stateless people who arrived to Shanghai after 1937 should live in a specific neighborhood in Shanghai. The district is called the Hongkou District, and they border the neighborhood between that road in the east to that road in the west, from the north to the south. And all those stateless people have to live there to bring any business or residence from the outside into there, and they can't go outside of this territory unless they have a permit to be in the other part of Shanghai. So in practice, basically the Japanese created a designated area to stateless refugees, a place that people call now as the Jewish ghetto of Shanghai. But what's interesting, if you ask me to think about, the Japanese, if you ask me, really selectively choosing their words. In that proclamation that they published, they never used the word Jewish people. They wrote stateless people who came to Shanghai after 1937. And they make it so special that way. So immediately out of this proclamation, they excluded the Baghdadi Jews, the Russian Jews who came before the refugees from the Holocaust, and many other Jews who might live in Shanghai, American, British, Dutch, or French. That proclamation was basically designated to the people who ran away from Hitler anyway. So it looks like they're trying to show the Nazis, okay, we will do something, first of all, to control, to see who is the Jews who ran away from you, etc. That's what it looks like. Unfortunately, there are not much documentation that explaining all that. The Japanese never documented properly or never even published a documentation of that. So we need to basically today to figure out why would it do so.
There's so much more we could talk about. We're out of time. I want to thank Devir Bargal for a fascinating exploration of the Jews of Shanghai. Where can people go to find out more and more about you, and if they want a tour with you in Shanghai?
First of all, whoever comes in Shanghai, I would be happy to welcome him or her. My email address is shanghaijews@hotmail.com. Shanghaijews.com is the website that people can find more information or email me directly. And then there's a lot of more and more literature about this and can find through Amazon, etc. But if somebody has any questions, I usually help happy to answer any questions. People shooting me through email, etc.
Thank you so much, Devir, and wonderful talking with you. I hope to see you again in Shanghai.
You're very welcome. We hope to see you again in Shanghai. I'm here. We hope you're coming again.
Me too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Jeffrey Orenstein, the chairman of the Memorial Scrolls Trust, the organization in London that repairs and distributes the extraordinary Czech memorial scrolls, which survived the Holocaust and have now been loaned to congregations throughout the world. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is from Eyal Golan and Moshe Peretz, Kama Yamim, a few days. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
רציתי לעצור הכל לחמרגעים אולי רק לטייל איתך קצת בין הצלילים רציתי רק לשיר איתך כבר לא מאתמול אז אם אנחנו יחד בוא נשכח מהכל עכשיו אפשר לשיר בשני קולות בשנינו יש כאן את אותה מנגינה לכתוב ביחד כמה רגשות על עצב על שמחה על ים חלומות
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.